nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
As you know, in this course, I've always stressed that this gives you a general way of looking at current flow in small devices. And the basic input is this H that describes your channel and the sigmas which describe your connection to the surroundings. And in a way, usually in this course, I do not stress so much, we do not spend a lot of time on the H itself, on exactly how you write it down. We have used the simplest model, the effective mass Hamiltonian. And the reason is that there are many courses in physics and chemistry and also in electrical engineering, where you can learn a lot more about the H's. But the part that is usually missing in most courses is that they don't quite tell you how to connect the contacts, essentially, or the sigmas. And that's what you really need in order to handle non-equilibrium problems of the type of interest for electronic devices. And so in general, I try to stress this general framework in this class rather than telling you a lot about the H's. But of course, you do need to know about how to write down the H. And as we go along, in future, you know, as people go to smaller and smaller devices, they will have different ways of writing down the H. You know, they might use atomistic Hamiltonians instead of effective mass Hamiltonians, and it will be a different H. But the basic equations you have developed, I believe that should still work. It's just how you write the H's and sigmas, but once you have those matrices, it's still the same equations, really. Okay. Now, so one example that we want to go through is how to write the H, including something called spin-orbit coupling. That's what we have been discussing the last few lectures. In fact, the last few lectures, what I was really trying to do is, instead of getting down to details of this type, giving you a general picture of where all this comes from. And one important take-home message from the rest of the lectures is these poly spin matrices, the sigmas. Because anytime you try to write the spin, this comes in very handy. If you're reading the literature, you'll see this everywhere. Even when you are trying to write it, this allows you to, you could write without ever defining a sigma. Like instead of this, I could have written this out, you know, in longhand. But it's just that this makes it a whole lot more compact and convenient. And so those matrices are something to keep in mind. That is this. You write sigma with a vector, but it's a funny kind of vector in the sense it's actually a 2x2 matrix. It's vector in the sense it's got three components. You have a sigma x, which looks like this. A sigma y, which looks like this. And a sigma z, which looks like this. And the other symbol that I'm using here, p, that's an operator. So let me just define it here. But p means minus I h bar, the grad operator. So what that means is, again, as you know, this has three components. So if I were to write it all out, let me write this on top here. If I were to write it all out, px would be minus ih bar ddx, etc., py. And all this dynamics of spins and how it interacts with electromagnetic fields, with the scalar potential, vector potential, all these were worked out like in 1930s to 50s, around that time frame, studying largely, I'd say, electrons in vacuum, studying the spectra of atoms. You see? So most of these principles were discovered in that context. And people figured out the mathematical framework that describes it. Whereas these days, of course, technology has progressed to a point that you can actually make use of these in real electronic devices. And so the context in which we are applying it is in the context of solids, usually, semiconductors or metals. And in solids, though, usually your starting point is something that you call the effective mass equation, which looks a lot like the Schrodinger equation. And so sometimes people forget that it's really not the Schrodinger equation. Because honestly, if you are starting from the Schrodinger equation, then one very complicated thing that should enter here right away is the nuclear potential. Because an electron going through a solid sees this very complicated large potential due to the nucleus. Right? But one of the nice things, one of the nice insights that came back again back in the 40s or 50s, was that electrons in solids often behave as if it's in vacuum with a different mass. Okay. But again, to keep in mind that this is really an effective mass equation rather than Schrodinger equation in that sense. Okay. So usually the part you'd have seen is this p squared over 2m. Now, why do I have an I there? Well, usually we are used to writing this effective mass equation with the psi being a scalar quantity. It's a scalar field. And I'm using the time-independent thing, so ordinarily it would be just a function of R space. Here, it is actually a two-component thing, because as we discussed, the basic thing about spin is that it gives you these two components, these up and down components, so that when you're thinking about a device, what used to be, say, described with 10 grid points now becomes 20, because each one effectively becomes twice as big. And here in this differential equation, then, it's like instead of having a single function, you got two functions, an up one and a down one. And so ordinarily, all that would happen is this matrix would get multiplied by I, which, of course, is the identity matrix. Actually, one of the things you can show is that in general, anytime you have a 2x2 Hermitian matrix, you can always write it as a linear combination of this and these other four, other three. So all four of these. So any Hermitian matrix would be some linear combination of these. That's just an incidental statement. Anyway, so that's the effective mass part. And if this was all that there was to it, there would be no good reason to bring in spin explicitly. Because then everything's just, all this would just break up into two separate differential equations because there's no off-diagonal coupling. And that's what you normally do. You just solve everything for one spin, multiply by two at the end. Okay. Now here, of course, you have this extra term here. That's this spin orbit term. And ordinarily, again, for the conduction band in silicon or even in gallium arsenide, you don't have any term like this, ordinarily, in a bulk semiconductor. But near a surface, because there is a very large electric field that's in the z direction. So I'll call z being then like the surface. So if you're talking about a two-dimensional, like a transistor-like structure, an MOS structure, so you've got these electrons flowing in this sheet, then z is like the perpendicular direction to that. So that's Z. So actually, I didn't quite write it right in the sense what people usually do is they take the magnitude of the electric field and lump it as part of this parameter in front. This is called the Rauschbach term. That's called the Rauschbach coefficient. So for any material, for many of these semiconductors, people have measured this, what this Rauschbach coefficient is. And that already includes the magnitude of the electric field. So usually the way it is defined is you'd have a z here. In the sense that the electric field could be written as the magnitude of the electric field times z, and the magnitude is already absorbed in the coefficient itself. There it is. Because that's what is experimentally measured directly. Yeah, because inside that structure, the electric field could be somewhat spatially varying. So what we really measure is some integrated effect of the whole thing. That's put into that. Okay. So this would be then the one form of the effective mass equation or effective mass Hamiltonian that one might want to use to describe current flow through a two-dimensional electron gas in gallium arsenide, let's say. Now, the question is, how do we understand this? How do we write the corresponding matrices? You know, as I said, usually we think of this H as, rather than work with differential equations, we have been working with matrix equations, in the sense that the way we would normally think is, I've got a two-dimensional system where I can set up sort of a lattice like this, and I can visualize this matrix. You see, the matrix equation would look something like E psi n is equal to sum over m h n m psi m, where these n's and m's, they run over all these different points in your lattice. Right? So every point n usually is connected to its nearest neighbors. And those would be these H and M's. Now, conceptually, there is the one difference between what we have discussed before and what I am doing now, is that usually when I write this, this H and M is just a number. Right? So usually your H and M, this would be like on the diagonal, it may be epsilon, and corresponding to the nearest neighbor couplings, we might have a minus T. That's what we have usually been doing. Epsilon is the diagonal element, HNN, and minus T is what couples to the nearest neighbors. But now, because we have spin in the story, remember, each one of these psi's at any point has two components to it. So it's a 2x1 column vector. What that means is each one of these is a 2x2 matrix. And, right, because the n's and m's run over all the actual lattice points. But conceptually, it is every lattice point is like two points, really, in your mind, right? So if you had to write this, just the first part, if you never had any spin orbit coupling, then it would be easy. What you do is you just say that the diagonal element is epsilon times I, where I is a 2x2 identity matrix, and the coupling to the nearest neighbor is minus T times I, where I is again this 2x2 coupling matrix. That's it. All that does is makes your matrix twice as big. You're just solving the same problem twice, nothing much. But what I really want to discuss is how these things get modified in order to include this kind of a term. That's what I really want to talk about. Now, one of the important things I have always stressed is that if you have a differential equation with constant coefficients, then you can define a corresponding dispersion relation. So, here again, as long as nothing is varying in space, no electric or magnetic fields as such, now, then you can write the solution psi as some quantity phi. You know, the psi is a function of R. You could write this as some 2x1 column vector, which is independent of space, it's a constant, but then multiplied by exponential I k dot r. What do I mean by k dot r? So, you know, if you write this out explicitly, it would look like kxx plus kyy plus kzz. But this is one point I've stressed all along, that as long as you have a differential equation with constant coefficients, solutions can be written in this form. And once you assume that solution, you can find a sort of EK relationship. And that's still kind of true, except that now because we have a couple differential equation, the process for finding Ek is a little more complicated. There's one more step here. And that is because, you see, if I substitute this solution in here, I'll not get just a dispersion relation that says E of k equals something. What I'll get is something that looks like this. So if I take this solution and substitute it in here, which I'll try to do, explain this in a minute, what we do. If we did that, then what you'd get is a 2x2 matrix looking like equation. That is, it would be E times this phi is equal to a 2x2 matrix here, because remember, this was a 2x2 differential operator. And that differential operator now becomes like numbers. Because remember, putting a solution like this in here, what it really does is it takes every p and replaces it with h bar k. Why is that? Because this gradient operator, p represents this gradient operator. The gradient operator acting on an exponential function like this simply multiplies it by h bar k. Right? That's the important mathematical fact to remember, which you've probably seen a few times now. I'll go through it one more time just to make sure that's clear. But that's the important mathematical fact to remember. That you see, if you take e to the power I k dot r and act on it with px, for example, let's say px is that operator. So what do we get? Well, we get minus I h bar d dx of this k dot r. Again, remember, it's kx x plus ky y plus kzz. So when I have to do this on e to the power I k dot r, so what do we get? Can you help me? Taking the derivative of an exponential. So first thing I have to do is just write whatever I had, put it back. Then I have to take the derivative of what's up here with respect to x. Okay, what's up here? Right. So what do you get then? Times ikx. So what that amounts to is, what this shows then is, that if you operate on this kind of a function with px, you get the same function back just multiplied by h bar kx. Same with y, same with z. What that means is, if you operate on this with the vector p, I mean something like this, the vector operator p, which has a x component of px, y component of py, and z component of pz, it basically gives you e to the power I k dot r times h bar vector k. That's all. Okay? So this is this little algebra to remember. Once you have gone through it, you know, you can remember the result very simply, that any function like this, when you operate on it with this operator, you just get a number times that thing. So nice thing about that is that whenever you take a function like this and act on it with a differential operator like that, it basically becomes an algebraic operator times that function. Of course, you still have a e to the power I k dot r sitting here, and a e to the power I k dot r sitting there, but those you can cancel. And so finally, you'd be left with an algebraic equation. Now, this is the thing that we have gone through before with just one by one differential equations, in which case, of course, what you got was e times a number phi is equal to some function of k times phi. And so whatever you got here, you call that the Ek relation. You just cancel the phis and you are done. You call that the Ek relation of this. Okay. Here, of course, with a 2x2 thing like this, you cannot just cancel this, that you realize. I mean, you cannot say E. That's not quite right. But what you have is now a 2x2 differential equation. And if you find its eigenvalues, you'd get two eigenvalues. And those would be the two energy eigenvalues. And what that means is that for every value of k, there will be two eigenvalues. And so if you plot that, so ordinarily, when you have an EK relationship, you might have got something like this. Just for every k, there was one value. Now, because it's a 2 by 2, when you solve it, you'll actually get two of them. And now, they may not be identical. Of course, if you only include this part, then they will be identical. If you include that, they won't be identical. They'll be somewhat different. In fact, what you can show, if we have time, I'll come back to this and show you this. But when you include the spin orbit term, it sort of becomes something like this. You kind of get two things, but they shift laterally with respect to each other. So for every k, there'll be two eigenvalues, but they're shifted a little bit laterally with respect to each other. So that's the effect of the spin orbit term. That's what it does to your dispersion relation.
Neither remains even.
Right. But there is another symmetry that people point out, and that is that whatever this is matches this usually. So they say for upspin plus k is like downspin minus k. That symmetry usually remains. As long as the interaction is of that form. So the thing to remember then is that with ordinary differential equations, I've always stressed that if it has constant coefficients, you can immediately get an E of k. The generalization that we are now doing, which actually goes beyond spin. I mean, here it's just 2 by 2. In general, when you're dealing with the valence band, you might actually have a 6 by 6 or 8 by 8. It might even get bigger, you see. But the point is that in the general case, when you have coupled differential equations, then instead of getting just one EK relation, what you end up with is a matrix H of K. And in this case, because the psi has two components, this matrix will be 2 by 2. And the way you'd find its eigenvalues now is there will be, for every K, two values. There will be two branches. Whereas if you're doing the valence band with a 6 by 6, then for every K, there would have been six values. And there would be kind of six branches around there. Heavy hole, light hole, spin orbit, all kinds of stuff there. But for conduction band, usually it's just a 2 by 2. This is it. Okay. Now, when you're trying to get a discrete lattice here, then in the discrete lattice model, it would have looked something like this. How would we get an EK relation out of this? Well, the equivalent to putting this in the continuum model, the equivalent thing you do here is you say, let us write psi of n as some psi of 0, or phi, let's say, some phi, times e to the power I k dot dn, where dn is the vector that tells you where point n is located. So you might have your origin someplace here, then dn is that vector. Wherever the origin is, join it to n. So just as in the continuum case, as long as everything is constant coefficients, solutions can be written this way. Similarly, in the discrete case, as long as things are periodic, which means if I stand here, whatever I see around me is exactly the same as what I see if I go someplace out there and look around me. As long as it's perfectly periodic, and that's a unit cell, you can write the solution in this form. So now if I substitute this in here, what I'd get is E phi is equal to, let me write this. So I've not done much, except that instead of psi n, or I guess this should be n, I have written phi times e to the power I k dot dn. Instead of psi m, I've written phi times e to the power I k dot dm. And the point is, this is just a number, a phase factor. I could take it over there, and I could write this in the form e phi is equal to summation over m h n m e to the power I k dot dm minus dn times phi. And this is the quantity that I could call my h of k. So what I'm trying to do is kind of write this in exactly the same form as what we had for the continuum case. For the continuum case, by substituting this in here, we got a nice algebraic equation, 2 by 2. Here, I'm starting from this discrete equation. Instead of a differential equation, there's a difference equation running over the lattice. N's and M's run over all points on the lattice. And you substitute this solution. And when you put it in there, and then you could take this over to that side, and you'll get something looking just like that. And just as this is a 2 by 2, this is also a 2 by 2. And so the point I'm trying to make after this is that given this, if you're trying to figure out how I'm going to set up my matrices, the point is what you want to do is try to make this look just like that. You choose all your H and M's, these couplings to the surroundings, in such a way that this looks just like that, as close as possible. That's the basic idea. I think when we take an example, it will get a little clearer. Okay. So bottom line is, let me just write that here. That's the h of k. And again, when we did this before for just a single band, no spins, we had something looking just like this. It's just that this was a number. And when you did this, you got the EK relationship, essentially. But as now it is a 2 by 2 matrix. And that's what you're trying to. Okay, so overall then, just to make sure we are clear on this, this is a differential equation, gives you a dispersion relation, h of k. This is the difference equation that looks like that, looks like a matrix kind of equation. But again, if it's periodic, you can assume solutions like what I had here, which I just erased. And when you put that in there, you'll get a 2 by 2 matrix equation looking like this, with the h of k is defined this way, in the difference, in the discrete version of things. Okay? And usually, one of the things we go through in the undergraduate course at some length is this principle of band structure. Namely, if you actually knew these from somewhere, h and m's, then what the corresponding ek relationship would be. So the way you do it is, given any h and m, you try to evaluate that sum. That would then give you the h of k. And again, if this was just 1 by 1s, that would be the end of it. If it's 2 by 2s, then you'd get 2 eigenvalues per k, etc. So that's how you get a dispersion relation. And in the simplest case, when you have, say, you know, for this discussion, you know, let's think of just a linear lattice like this. Then with epsilons on the diagonal and minus t on the off diagonal. So can you tell me what E of k would give you then? What do you get for this sum? This is something we have done before. Okay. Remember, when I try to do this sum, what you do is you stand at one point and do this sum over all points. But only terms in the sum that contribute are the point right there, and the one next to it to the right, and the one next to it to the left. So what do you get from the point M equals N when I do that sum? Just epsilon. Because HNN is epsilon, and if DM is equal to DN, there is no phase factor. Okay. Now when I go to the next term to the right, I get minus T, but now DM minus DN, that really represents this vector, which is, if the lattice spacing is A, sorry, I drew it the wrong way, DM minus DN is that vector. And the lattice spacing is A, that's like A in the x direction. So you'd pick up a minus T e to the power I kx A. And then when you write the other one, you'd get minus T e to the power minus I kx A. And then when you combine all this, you get epsilon minus 2T cosine kx A. Right? This is what we have gone through before. Now, how do you make that correspond to parabolic dispersion? Because, you know, usually when you are doing this, you have h bar squared k squared over 2m star. So how do you make this look like parabolic, you know, something that depends on k squared a squared? Can you remind me? Do you remember? The usual procedure is, from here, you then say that we are only doing this for small k, because after all, the discrete lattice and the continuum will be equivalent only when Ka is small. So if Ka is small, then what is cosine? It's like 1 minus k squared a squared over 2. That's the approach. And so when you put that in, you get equal to epsilon minus 2t plus t a square times kx square. So then you say, well, you're now getting an ek relationship that looks like a constant plus a parabola. That would be the usual argument. Now the thing is, you could run this whole argument in reverse. In reverse, in the sense, you could say, well, I know that my EK relationship, people tell me, for the conduction band should look something like this. So what kind of a discrete lattice should I use? You know, what should my HNMs be? Well, I could say, well, I have a K squared here. Let me write that as, you know, half K squared as 1 minus cosine. Let me go backwards. You know, K squared as 2 times 1 minus cosine. Because for small k, those are equivalent. And once you do that, you'll get something like this. And then you can write it like this, as e to the power plus something and e to the minus something. And then say, okay, so this must be the diagonal element. That must be the one connecting to the right. And this must be the one connecting to the left. So what I'm trying to say is, if someone gave you an EK relationship and you're trying to figure out what's the right HNMs to use to model this in a discrete lattice, what you do is this: do this whole band structure in reverse, essentially. Start with an EK, turn it into cosines and sines, write it like this, and then whatever this is will tell you what's the coupling to the right, whatever this is will tell you the coupling to the left, whatever this is will tell you the coupling right there. You see? You run the whole process in reverse. And so that's what we'll try to do then with this. What we are trying to figure out is how to get something like this into our model. Because we want to set up a discrete lattice, write a matrix, so that we can actually describe this spin-orbit coupling. And we have to do this thing in reverse. So I'm kind of reminding this. This is reminding you of this because you have seen this before. But this is very important to keep in mind in order to see what I'm going to do next. So first step then is to get this h of k, you know, this e phi equals h of k times phi. So what is this h of k? Well, As I mentioned, you just substitute solutions of the form exponential ik dot r. And whenever you do that, all that happens is p gets replaced by h bar k. And it becomes an algebraic equation. That's a differential operator. But what I have here is just an algebraic term. And what you'll get is something like this. H bar squared k squared over 2m star I, just h bar k. And then here it will be eta sigma dot z cross k. That's it. So now can you help me write this out? Assuming that k is a vector in the xy plane, so it looks something like kxx plus kyy. So this h of k that we have is equal to h bar squared k squared over 2m star I plus eta times. Can you help me with what goes in there? So it's eta sigma dot z cross k. So what is z cross this? It will be kx, but in the y direction. So when I take sigma dot that, what I'll get is sigma y kx. And then when I take z cross y, I'll get ky, but in the negative x direction. And so I'll get minus sigma x ky. So that's it. Sometimes people use this chain rule to turn it around and write, you know, when you have A dot B cross C, you can write it as B dot C cross A. So sometimes that helps you get to this. But point is, yeah, that's the final result, really, however you do it. Okay. So this is the H of K that we are trying to emulate. And remember, what I've written here is a 2x2 matrix that is a function of K, whose elements are functions of K. That's what I've written. So from this, if I were trying to discover, actually let me write this up here. We don't really need this anymore. From here, then, if I'm trying to discover what I should do in this discrete lattice, how I should write it, then the way to do this part would have been something like this. View this as h bar square over 2m star times kx square plus ky square. And what we want to do is, instead of this, try to write it as cosines, so that I can turn them into exponentials, and then I can figure it out. Remember, I'm trying to do the band structure in reverse. So what I can do is put a square here, a square there, and put a square down here. And then, I guess, I'll use this idea that cosine of a small quantity like kxa is approximately equal to 1 minus kx square a square over 2, right? So I could put a divided by 2 here. And this is what you usually, this is what you usually been writing as t. So this would then be 2t times, that guy is 1 minus cosine kxa. And then plus 1 minus cosine kya. should be equal to 4t minus t e to the power ikx a minus t e to the power minus ikx a minus t to the power plus iky a minus t to the power minus iky. So that's the standard parabolic EK relation. I'm writing it in terms of cosines and then writing the cosine as a sum of these two exponentials. And why am I doing that? Because once I'm here, I can immediately read off what the couplings in my matrix should be. It should be 4t on the diagonal, minus t to the right, minus t to the left, minus t to the top, minus t to the bottom. It's right there, right? And of course, there's an, with spin included, there's an I in front of it. So it's just all of these multiplied by I. So HNN would be 4ti. HN n plus 1 to the right would be minus ti. That's it. Done. So this was trivial. I mean, you know the answer. Only thing I'm showing you formally how you'd do it. Because what I really want to show you is how to do this one. This is where there will be no simple intuitive way to write it down. But formally, we'd do exactly the same thing. Okay. So the trick, the way it would work is the following. That here it was k squared, so we turned it into cosines. Here it is just linear, k. So what should we do? Turn it into sines. Because as you know, just as cosine for small arguments looks like this, sine for small arguments is just this. Just linear. Sine x is just x. Okay. So what we'll do then is, instead of this, I'll write eta over a sigma y k x a minus sigma x k y a. And then, of course, instead of k x a, I'll put in sine k x a. Instead of k y a, I'll put sine k y a. Because we're trying to put this on a discrete lattice, and the only place we expect them to be equivalent is when a is small, when k a is small. So you put in the sines. And then the sines you expand in terms of exponentials. So it'll look like eta over a times 2i Did I do that right? Because, yes, good. I missed all that. So the first guy is multiplied by sigma y, like I wrote. But the second one is really multiplied by sigma x. Right. Now I think it's okay. Right? And the eta, of course, multiplies the whole thing. And I put in a 2i here, because exponential plus ix minus exponential minus ix divided by 2i, that's sine. Similarly here, that divided by 2i, that's the other sine function. Okay, so now you see you can again read off exactly what you have to do right there. So what that means is the coupling to the right element should be that much. It will be eta over 2ia sigma y. Coupling to the left element would be negative of that. Coupling to the top element would be this one. Coupling to the lower element would be that one. That's it. It's right there. Okay. Again, band structure in reverse. That if I had started from the discrete thing, you would have first got this, then turned it into sines, and then got that, that's how it would have worked your way there. Okay. So overall then, this is how you could get the spin orbit interaction into the H. Because what you then do is, you have some lattice in here, and you can write the diagonal element. It's just 4t times I that we had from here. That comes from this term. If I want to write the coupling to the right, the usual term would be minus t times I. And now that I have the Rauschbach term, I have to add the Rauschbach term there. And how much is that? Well, that's this coefficient of e to the power I kxa, which is this quantity. So it'll be eta over 2ia times sigma y. Etc. So usually without the Rauschbach term, each one was different. This one is different from that, is different from that, is different from that. I'm sorry. Without the Rauschbach term, they were all the same. They would have been just minus ti. But now the Rauschbach term, each one will be different. This one will be this. This one will be the negative of that. The one going above and the one going below, one will be sigma x. The one other will be sigma x. It would be minus sigma x, right? Because as you can see from here, each one of these is a little bit different. That's what we'll get in. Okay? So in terms of calculating things, you know, that's how you would set up the H. I've kind of discussed how you set up the sigmas before. That is, the sigmas usually, you know, you have magnets here. And usually, if you use the up and down of the magnet as your basis, then the sigmas just usually have a simple structure. Namely, whatever you would have written for up, you know, so sigma 1, sigma 1. So if without spin, whatever you'd have written, you'd repeat it again if it was non-magnetic. If it is magnetic, then this might be a little different from that. It might get complicated if the contact happened to be pointing in some other direction. Then, as I've said, in that basis, it would look something like this. But then you have to transform it back to a common basis. So that would be the overall mathematical procedure in terms of setting up and doing calculations. That's how you write the sigmas. That's what you write the H. And once you've written these, rest, same equation, same procedure. Everything's much the same. But as I've often stated, you know, that calculating things and then understanding things, those are two separate parts. And you can use each one to help you with the other. Okay? So what I'll try to describe to you a little more is some of the consequences of this term. Like what do you expect physically? Because physically what happens is something like when an electron comes in here with some spin, because of the spin orbit term, it actually rotates as it goes through the device. And so that's how it affects what current you actually have coming out the other end. But that's the physical interpretation, which we'll have to talk about, discuss this, right? But broadly, today, experimentally, the situation is people have done experiments on semiconductors where the spin orbit term plays a major role, and people have measured these coefficients for all kinds of quantum wells and structures, it's known. Whereas a lot of the spin valve experiments, the one where you have magnetic contacts, those are usually done in non-magnetic materials, not on semiconductors. I mean, those are usually done with materials which do not have much of a spin orbit interaction. So for example, this may be copper, or could be an insulating oxide. That's where most of the important experiments are. What people are trying to do now is actually build magnetic contacts onto semiconductor quantum wells, where you'd actually have both of these things, namely both the interesting things coming from your contacts and maybe the spin orbit interaction that would allow you to control some of these things. But those are things where no concrete experiments are really available yet. I mean, maybe one or two at this time, that people are just getting started on that. Yeah, let me stop here today and next day we'll...